Hello. Today in the Loopcast, I have Amanda Moore, and we are discussing her time in the MAGA milieu, in the MAGA movement. It was about a year. One of the big reasons that we kind of wanted to do this show was that for all the coverage of the MAGA movement, for all the kind of that high visibility that's been placed on the movement in all parts of it, right? So from Q, the explicitly white supremacist parts of it, from Trump himself, et cetera, there hasn't been a lot of like personal kind of undercover journalistic examinations of this movement for various reasons, as we'll kind of dig into the show. And I was kind of very fascinated by this because, I don't mean to make this personal, but as a person of color, kind of going to these spaces in person has kind of been prohibitive, right? So it became more prohibitive as the pandemic hit, and then maximal prohibited when being vaccinated started becoming problematic in these spaces. So I was just, the online spaces are very easy to access. They don't take a lot of skill to kind of enter and examine, but the meat space, literally MEAT and MEET, is kind of harder to get into. And we really want to, within the context of the show, and sort of kind of pick that apart and look at it through the lens of Amanda's experience. So with that, please welcome Amanda Moore. How's it going?
I'm good. I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So I was kind of debating with myself about how to start the show. And I think for me, the first question I wanted to ask is, what was the precise moment or the precise question that kind of made you want to go undercover? What was that decision like?
There's not really a precise moment or question. Like you were just saying, I'm obviously not a person of color. I'm blonde and white, and I have light eyes, and so it's always been very easy for me to kind of be in these spaces. And I come from, like a background that is not, I don't come from a fascist background, but I was like a libertarian. As a teenager and then in my early 20s. And people that I knew within that movement did move on to become fascists, or they kind of made a full left like I did. And so I've always kind of been able to go to an event and just cross the line. There was a Laura Loomer event a few years ago in DC, and I was actually meaning to go to the protest side, and I got like mixed up because it was so close to my office that when I walked out of my office, I literally walked straight into the Nazi side of the rally. And nobody kicked me out. And so I went around and, like took some pictures of some of the Proud Boys that were there and things like that. So it's always been something I've been able to do in small pieces. I guess, the literal moment I realized that this was going to be a little longer term. Was obviously January 6th, standing there and being present at the Capitol for that. But it's not, what I did was not something that's out of character for me in any way, to kind of go and just document whatever I see.
So, can you give us kind of a timeline? So, it starts January 6th, 2021, and goes to, I want to say November 2021, but can you give us kind of this
Sure.
broad,
So
like
it's
a very broad perspective?
sure, November 14th, 2020. And then I was docked September 27th, 2021. And I tried to continue on and go to another event, but I was banned from the event. And that would have been at the end of October. So yeah, my first event within this like COVID world was the first Million MAGA March, or the first DC Stop the Steal rally, which was about a week after the election was called. And it was that Stop the Steal rally. Then there was a second Stop the Steal rally in DC in December of 2020. And then the third Stop the Steal rally turned into January 6th. And then from there, I would go on to various conferences and QAnon meetups kind of across the country.
So you're going undercover, right? So you're not, so how, I really like was kind of fascinated by like, how does that work in for somebody, like my understanding of you is that you're not a journalist, you're not like a spy, and you're not like a cop. You're just a kind of regular person. And when you start going undercover, when you start sort of entering this space, what was kind of the prep? Like the, let's start with the mental prep. Like, what do you, is it, did you have to create another sort of iteration of Amanda? Like, here's Amanda, the MAGA person, and here's Amanda, the real person. Like, what is the mental prep to start to go undercover?
So for my alter ego, I literally, she's just me, but if I was a racist fascist, I knew it was going to be too hard to, you know, like tone down my personality. Like, we're not, you know, I'm not tricking some guy from Kentucky into thinking I'm going to be his trad wife, right? Like, and you can see it's reflected in who I hung out with. I hung out with people who are fine with my personality. That's going to be like people from the Mid-Atlantic, people from New England, and people from, you know, like Michigan and like Chicago. Because it's just, you know, I talk fast and I have a big personality, and I knew it was going to be too much to try to turn that off and also be this other person. So, you know, if you're like a blank slate going in undercover, you know, maybe I would have tried to be like a Haley Adams or something. You know, out there, you know, toting a gun around and hanging out with people who are doing, you know, violent crimes. But that's, if I was a racist fascist, I wouldn't be like that. You know, I would do exactly what I did. So that's how I handled it. I used a fake last name, but I even used my real first name because I also knew that there was no way I'd remember to answer to a fake first name. Plus, a lot of these events, you have to, you know, buy tickets and things like that. So I also had a PO box. I said I was from Annapolis, so I got a PO box up there and changed my credit cards to bill my billing address to Annapolis instead of in DC. And so that way, if anybody looked at, you know, to kind of verify me, they could see. And the fake last name I picked, my real middle name starts with the same letter. So my real middle name is Lee, and my fake last name was Lily. And so I had all of my credit cards, my bank print my name as Amanda L. Moore. So if anybody asked, I could just be like, oh, middle name. But that was overthinking it. Nobody ever got that detailed and like trying to figure anything out. Nobody even Googled me as far as I can tell, because they, if they had figured out, you know, anything about me, they would have seen articles that I had previously written. They would have found a bunch of stuff about me. So that's what I did. And then, you know, I've been consuming like far right media for a really long time. This is always, I mean, this didn't happen, you know, in a vacuum. You know, like I was saying, like I've been politically active since I was like 12 years old. So I've always had this interest in kind of tracking the far right. You know, I was at the QAnon rally in 2019 in DC, like the first ever like QAnon rally. And so I've listened, you know, to Nick Fuentes for a long time. I listened like to the Daily Show. I mean, so a lot of things in terms of like language and like social cues that they might have or in jokes, like I already got it. I didn't really have to like study or research it. Yeah, so that's kind of a broad answer. I hope that's in the ballpark of what you're looking to figure out.
I mean, that's kind of mind blowing. Like I just, like usually when people like go through those motions of like setting up, you know, kind of not fake identity, but sort of a kind of abstraction of their own identity and kind of like with a twist, it's just amazing that you kind of just figured this out ad hoc and you were kind of just doing it as you went along, or was this kind of more organized and disciplined?
I mean, when I was at the Stop the Steal rallies in DC, like I wasn't, like, people would ask for my number and I'd be like, oh, my, like, just give me your number. Like my phone's not working, you know, like whatever. Like I would make something up, or I'd be like, I don't know, I would just lie. But when I went to CPAC, which was my next event after there was January 6th. And then like I stayed in a hotel room like directly next to the White House for the inauguration. Obviously, you know, nothing happened. And then for CPAC, you know, I got a burner number. And so I had like a little bit of a background story, but it wasn't the background story I ended up running with long term. But I, you know, I had just planned to kind of like go and record some stuff and like dip out. You know, it wasn't like I was like, oh, I'm gonna go to CPAC and like this is my life now. But while I was there, you know, I met a Nazi. and he asked for my information and then asked me to help him out with, you know, some contacts he was trying to make in Congress. And that's when I was like, oh shit, this is, you know, like I got to do this now. And that's kind of when I made things more solid. That's like when I got the PO box and everything. One thing I learned was that you can use whatever name you want on your credit card if you buy stuff online, because nothing ever got flagged, even though I used my fake last name when I would make purchases. So, I mean, it was pretty wild to like figure out on my own. And I spent hours and hours trying to research like tiny cameras that you could buy or like microphones and things like that. And like most of the stuff is super gimmicky. And I was willing to commission somebody who like would be able to make something custom and super fast. But I, you know, like with COVID, it was hard to get a hold of people. And even though like I'm kind of, my real job is like kind of in the entertainment industry, so many people left it during COVID that I couldn't find anybody. So I, you know, was just using like a regular like wireless microphone attached to a cell phone to record stuff. I didn't even have, you know, the fancy spy equipment that you think of when you think of someone being undercover.
That's kind of blowing my mind. Like it's just off the shelf. Like you just go into Amazon and be like teeny camera and see where it goes. It's something that I kind of find fascinating about these spaces is, did you ever like feel physically threatened or physically like, I know this might sound like super personal, but I can't like in my own imagination, I can't like separate out the violence either as rhetoric or as imagery from the MAGA space, right? It's like, I think of, you know, 1/6, the guy with the Holocaust denial shirt, or 1/6 itself. Like, was there ever a moment like where like you were physically threatened, like actual, like with actual violence, not just, you know, get out of here, shoo, or like, can you describe that for us?
Yeah, it never happened. I was never threatened by anybody. But, you know, I was also never caught. I mean, I was caught, but I wasn't caught in person. If my Twitter account didn't exist, like, unfortunately, I was running a Twitter account where I was kind of like posting from things as I was at them. And part of it was that people would send me money when like this was completely self-funded. And so even though I was only getting a couple hundred bucks on Patreon or like people would randomly cash at me, like I literally couldn't have done it without that. So, you know, if I had been like rich, I wouldn't have gotten called because I wouldn't have had to share what I was doing until I was done. Right. But yeah, I mean, no, I mean, I'm sure if they had figured it out, there are some situations I would have been in that would have been extremely dangerous. And that was something that really weighed on me, especially after I was doxxed. I was doxxed on 4chan at the end of September. And then I was supposed to go to an event at Trump Doral like the next week. And I had already paid for it. And it was like $1,300 loss. And I just ate it. Because, you know, I talked about it with people and we decided it probably wasn't safe. And then I was supposed to go to the QAnon John event in Vegas. And then after that, I was going to go to NatCon in Orlando. And it had seemed like only the QAnon people realized who I was. And so we thought maybe I could still go to NatCon. And that was going to be with like people who are fascists and Nazis and, you know, current or former members of, you know, hate groups that I know that I was going with. And I was getting really worried about that, like not sleeping over it, but they ended up, you know, figuring it out before. Because, I mean, you know, it would have been quite the gamble to have my docs out there and still try to go to something, but ended up not being an issue.
Interesting. So before we get into like specific stuff, I kind of want to end this overview part with kind of you doing some introspection and whether that the year spent in this milieu was like in the original questions, I have it as smart or stupid, but I kind of want you to kind of give us like a roundup. Like, do you feel that this was the right thing to do? Did you feel like this was the smart thing to do? And, you know, if not that, then why was it stupid? Why was it not useful? Like, how do you consider your time undercover as a whole?
Oh, I'm very glad I did it. I mean, my only regret with it is that it ended early, right? I mean, that being said, if like any point of this question is asking, like, do I think other people should do it? No, I think if other people do it, it's stupid. which is like hypocritical, but I mean, there's a very specific type of person that could do what I did, and other people shouldn't fuck with it. I don't know if I can swear, I'm sorry. Other people shouldn't mess with it, right? Like, there's a level of danger, like not just physical danger, but also to your brain. and I don't think people should do it. That being said, like, I would do it again tomorrow, you know, like if I could just erase everybody's memory of my dogs, like it was good to do. So, but not for other people.
So something I kind of find interesting is that I think you might be the only person covering this space, and like, this might not be accurate, but I'll just say it, like, you might be the only person covering this space in detail post January 6th. So that sort of post Trump Biden kind of period. And what did you like find out that others would not or could not? Because you seem to be the only person who's doing this kind of, who did this kind of work, I should say, past tense. Because I don't think, like, looking at other journalists, like, there's no Shane Bauer, there's no kind of, I guess this is an old-timey reference, but there's no, like, John Howard Griffin, there's no Black Like Me, somebody who is going deep undercover and covering this. So, you know, in that regard, you know, what did you find out that others could not or would not find out without this kind of work?
I mean, there's just so much. you know, kind of broadly, like, a lot of the stuff I went to, I mean, the reason that nobody did what I did, because outlets, you know, had mask mandates, and journalists, you know, were, you know, rightfully concerned about getting COVID. And you had to be willing to, like, completely, you know, get rid of the mask, get rid of all COVID precautions, or you can't do this stuff. You'll never be accepted if you wear a mask. And so, you know, that's an obstacle, and it's also like an ethical issue in general to go undercover, and adding in COVID, it's like a huge ethical issue, especially from, you know, November 2020 to like probably June of 2021 or whenever people got vaccinated. So a lot of these things I went to on the QAnon side were so small, you know, and we have, you know, there's like live streams of the big events like QAnon John and Clay Clark, but some of the stuff I went to, I'm the only person who recorded it. you know, maybe somebody recorded something with their GoPro and it sounds like it's in a tin can and you can't see who's talking. But like, I went to stuff and I recorded, you know, what would have been a lost year of various QAnon events. And I, you know, I was able to kind of draw connections between people who know each other, things that you wouldn't see online, you know, unless you're Facebook friends with somebody who's, you know, very deeply personal hidden Facebook profile. You don't know who's hanging out with who, but if you're at the bar with them, you sure know who knows each other, which kind of gave me a jumping off point when it came to, you know, looking for information about people. And then, you know, journalists who have written about some of the guys that I was hanging out with, I've been able to be like, yes, and here's this as well. And it's something that, you know, you wouldn't know if, because these people aren't going to talk to you, they're not going to give you answers. And then in the moment, you know, I would hear in person, you know, conspiracies and things that I wouldn't see it online for like a couple of weeks after I had heard it. So by the time things kind of trickle to Telegram, they've already been circulating around people at the events. And I've, you know, I've said in the past, and I still stand by it, that I think kind of they would use us as test audiences, like a comedian will do a test set to see, because if people's paid $500 or $1,000 to come to your event and they aren't very receptive to your conspiracy theory, you know, you might need to workshop it a little bit before you put it on the internet, because the internet is forever, but people who are there in person are more willing and likely to forget things.
That's kind of interesting, the idea of a live event, of a meet space as a workshop. Like I had never thought of, like, until I heard your interview with Jared Holt, like I had never thought of that. Like the idea that, you know, you're going to the Ramada Inn, you know, conference space, you know, there's like maybe five people and they're, you know, the speaker's kind of testing stuff. And then the refined material is the one hitting Telegram, 4chan or whatever. Is that like the dynamic, is that describing the dynamic correctly?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not everything that's that way, but I saw it multiple times. Especially something that really stands out to me is like, referring to like the hospitals as the new Holocaust. That language, I watched that get used in person and then it was moved, you know, to the internet. And even with that, like the way they presented it to us, it was the first set of VIP the night before like an event, and they said it there. And then I could tell like the next day when they said it at the main event with more people, they structured the speech a little different. So, you know, just some of that. I think too, it's also like, sometimes things just need explaining, you know, and it's you, people are this way. You have an idea and you think this part of it's obvious, but other people don't see how that part is obvious. And so, you know, if something drew a lot of questions, then they also would know like to preemptively answer those questions before, you know, just dropping a conspiracy theory and walking away.
So these are queue spaces. So what happens when, you know, when you start like exploring out, like what was the, like, would you see the same dynamic in like, I don't know, not CPAC, but something lesser than CPAC, but related to it? What are the threads in this milieu? Like, would you see, like, let's start here. Would you see the same people at a Q meetup that you would see at CPAC, that you would see at like a Stop the Steal meetup? Like, how does, what, you know, what was that dynamic? Or was it just oh, go ahead.
Well, at like January 6th, like, so the night before January 6th or the day before, there was like a whole January 5th, there was like a whole party in the streets of DC, of course. And like, I remember like, messaging Mike Rothschild and just being like, I don't recall ever seeing like there's dudes in 3%er gear, you know, grilling hot dogs with dudes and Where We Go One, We Go All shirts. And like, that was the first time in my, you know, memory that I could kind of put that together. So I would see the QAnon people, obviously I saw them at those things. You see QAnon stuff, CPAC, that like outright fascist stuff I was at was a younger crowd. And so, I mean, they would make fun of the QAnon people. Had QAnon people shown up, I'm sure they would have been welcomed with open arms. But, you know, QAnon people that I would talk to would generally be old enough to be my parent or older, whereas the fascists were more my age or younger. So, like, there's not really any QAnon people at, like, an American Populist Union event across the street from Turning Point USA, because it's meant for college kids. But definitely, you know, at CPAC, there would be QAnon everywhere.
That's, that demographic question is kind of interesting, because like the Q people, like, I don't know, in my conception, like the Q people are kind of goofy, but they're older. But like the new fact here, the new sort of observation that you've offered is, like the fascist crowd, they're our age, like they're in their 20s and 30s, which is maybe even younger. I don't actually know what your age is. But could you describe the fascist crowd a bit? Like, are they not like explicitly Nazi, or is it you're kind of, we're calling them fascists because you're kind of inferring it from your conversation and sort of how they would present their values?
So I'll caveat by saying I'm 33. So, you know, there could be like an older group of fascists saying, you know, that's not my age. That's like not who I would hang out with, right? I'm calling them fascists because they are, you know, current or former members of Identity Europa, Patriot Front. They say stuff like, I would like a friendlier Nazi Germany. They've done things like invite Richard Spencer to be a speaker at their events. So I don't think I'm, you know, really reaching too hard here. they're pretty much obviously undeniably a fascist or Nazis in some cases. But yeah, they would be all our age. Some of this stuff I would go to, you know, the organizers would be as young as like 18 years old. And then I think probably the oldest would be a little bit under 40, so maybe like 38 or so at some of these events.
Oh man, that's disheartening. I have to really be honest with you. Like that's really disheartening because it's like the Q people are made fun of, they're kind of isolated and they're older. So the expectation is they're gonna, you know, for lack of a better phrase, die off first, and the fascists are kind of younger. But I mean, did you ever get a sense of the younger group of the fascists, like where they were employed? What do they do in their normie life? This has kind of like been a struggle for me. It's like, okay, you engage Richard Spencer's content, your idea, you know, Identity Europa or whatever, but like, what do you do during the day? Did you ever get a sense of like what their normie life is, what their day-to-day is like, or was it just, you know, you got that slice and then you kind of left it alone?
Some are lawyers, some work in embassies. some work, you know, completely within the right wing, like sphere, doing, you know, media or whatever. But a lot of them, you know, people don't want to talk about their personal lives too much. So it's very impolite to ask people what they do for a living, you know, if it's relevant or if they're comfortable, like, having that out there, you know, they'll volunteer it. But a lot of people, you know, don't even use a real first name. So it would be harder to say, but, you know, definitely I hung out with people who, you know, practice law, who work in embassies, who, you know, write right-wing propaganda. You know, some of them are low-level elected officials. it just depends. Some of them have family money. There's not really one answer that I found. It's kind of all across the board.
Interesting. That's really disturbing. I think I have to kind of mull that over a bit. but I mean, like, when you started going to conferences and meetups, like, how did you define that journey? Because I'm just kind of fascinated because you've already touched on, like, you've been to Q places, you've been to Fash places, but like for you as somebody who's going undercover, how did you define that journey? Was it just like, I'm going to show up to a Q place, I'm going to make some friends, and then from the friends go from there? Like, what is that thinking and planning, you know, specifically to how you would, you know, pull on threads and kind of explore this milieu?
Well, some of the things were, you know, very like well known and publicized, and those are the things that were like live streamed everywhere, right? So like CPAC, QAnon John, like Clay Clark, these are things that got, you know, like Will Sommer like live tweeting, you know, from QAnon John until he was kicked out. So these were like things that were duh. But a lot of it would just be like, once I got to know people and then like, I know what they're going to, and then like, they tell you like, you know, oh, let's, you know, make sure you go to this. And I own a business in the real world. And in reality, it was completely gutted by COVID, and I made like negative, like 30 grand. But in fashion world, I, you know, my business was fine, and it was like a little bit different than what it is. And so people knew I could work from wherever. And I also like presented as though I had a bunch of money. So like travel and like whatever didn't matter. So people would just tell me, you know, what was going on or where they were going. And that's it. you know, I started off, I bought tickets to CPAC, and then I bought tickets to, at the same time, to a Lauren Boebert fundraiser in Colorado that was May 1st. So I bought the tickets in February. CPAC was the end of February. And then at the same time, I bought that May 1st ticket. And then it kind of just ended up like escalating, and I went to a bunch of stuff in between. And yeah, I didn't really, I mean, it was hard to make a plan too, because people kind of announced stuff at the last minute where they're like, oh, we're going to have this event in, you know, 2 weeks. You know, I remember sitting in a hotel in Miami, and my flight has been like delayed, and I'm stuck in Miami overnight, and I'm coming back from Trump Doral. And I look at my phone, it's like, oh, Roger Stone has an event in Tampa on Friday. And I was like, well, guess I'm coming back to Florida in 5 days. And I did. And so, you know, there wasn't really much ability to like create a huge plan in advance, just because they don't know what they're doing in advance.
I mean, is it fair to say that the space is kind of disorganized, or is it just that sort of, that behavior is kind of like intentional? Like, you're not supposed to know where everybody's meeting up until like 2 days out.
I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of these people are just bad event planners in general. But like, I work in live events, and like, it's always a hectic, chaotic mess. So when you're planning something that's, you know, a staple like CPAC or NatCon, like these are every year, these are, you know, normal events. If you're trying to like plan like a one-off thing, it's much harder, and it's much easier to plan it kind of in a short time frame, especially everything is so, you know, like you just never know what's going to happen, especially in the early days closer to January 6th. You know, everybody's a little bit on the edge, and then of course events would get protested. So I think it was just like inexperienced event planners wanting to capitalize on like energy from the movement as fast as possible, and kind of like get people like together while they're still willing to spend money. And I think then also there is that element of like trying to keep things under wraps. But usually that's like smaller stuff where they don't release the name of the restaurant you're having, you know, dinner at or whatever. Like if something's like at Trump Doral, they're not, you know, that's not really a factor. Though things will still be planned last minute. And I think it also adds like a sense of urgency. Like you have to get tickets like right now, because this event's been announced and it's been 4 weeks. Don't you want to go? I think it's also part of a marketing plan for some people.
So then could you describe like some of the more, like, I don't want to say well-known, but sort of the celebrities of this space? Like the DIA guy, Michael Flynn, is in this space, QAnon John. I think those are kind of well-known to a lot of people, but are there any other celebrities in this space that kind of go unnoticed, that have like huge online followings, but aren't really examined by, I hate using this phrase, but I'm going to use it, like the mainstream media or the non-disinformation media or whatever you want to call it? Yeah, let's start there with like the examination of celebrity in this space, celebrities.
Well, I'm going to say like there's very few people who are going to like achieve a Michael Flynn level of celebrity. So anybody that's like him is going to be known. In terms of like influencers with large online followings, I mean, one would be Brad Barton, who is a lifelong MLM grifter, who's, you know, leached onto the QAnon movement and has had multiple events, some of which I've attended. So yeah, he's somebody, and you know, a lot of that is just, you can go to these other events and you can network in person and get people to trust you and buy tickets to your event. He's also like enemies with QAnon John. They hate each other. So he is probably the biggest one. I mean, Vaccine Police made news a handful of times now, and I've known him for a while. But I wouldn't say he's like a celebrity unless things have gotten really bleak in the QAnon sphere. Because even in a QAnon setting, he's like a really weird dude. So yeah, he's like difficult to be around. He's so weird. But yeah, Brad Barton is definitely, I think, the biggest example of what you're talking about. And then, you know, I would see, I guess, like, it's a little harder to say on the fascist side, because I don't really know what would constitute a celebrity on that end. So I think as far as celebrity, Brad Barton might be the only person I would say. And maybe Vaccine Police, who's now famous in mainstream media, I guess, for recommending we drink tea. But
that's kind of interesting. Like, I think you just hit on an interesting dichotomy, which is the Q space tends to be, like, I hate using this, but I think, like, I think it was Emmy who kind of first mentioned to it, but I think I'm stealing some of her ideas, but it almost seems like a fandom where celebrity being loud, being ostentatious and kind of weird is celebrated, where like the fash side is kind of scary. Like they're, you know, Michael Flynn is like, I hate using this word, but he's kind of a loser. He's almost comes off as a grifter. Whereas like on the fash side, I don't think I can name anybody from that side. I have a conception of their ideology, but there's nobody that's visually striking, right? I wouldn't describe it as a fandom, right? So like, how would you like describe that tension? Or is there a tension? Let's start there. Like between the kind of the fandom of QAnon versus the kind of low key, I don't even know if low key is the right word here, but the kind of low key wanting to, you know, be secret, but still meet up fash side of the movement.
Well, I don't really see much interaction. I mean, I never, like, again, you know, these kind of people, they're boomers, they're older. It's hard for me to determine like what's a celebrity, but like, I mean, like Nick Fuentes obviously has like, you know, the Quakers, and now there's another Quaker war against Joe Kent. So there's definitely like some of that, but it's not in the same way of like Q. And I think that's just because they don't have the numbers. So, you know, if you're asking me like, who's a celebrity online, it's Q space people don't talk about, like Brad Barton's easy to me because he's got like 150,000 Telegram followers. He's got like 100,000 YouTube followers and like 150,000 Facebook followers. But when it comes to like the young kids, there's not, you know, like, there just aren't as many people in this country who are willing to openly embrace like Nick Fuentes' rhetoric, or even if they're willing to agree with the things he says. You know, he's like, what, 22 years old? Like, that really like kind of makes it difficult. Like someone who's like 35, is going to get their, you know, daily updates from Nick Fuentes, right? Unless they're me. So I think that it makes it a little harder. You know, you don't have... The fascist side is also, I think, a little bit more like broken up. So like there was a point in time with QAnon where everybody held hands and was so happy together, and Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell and Patrick Byrne and General Flynn, and they were all besties forever. And even if that wasn't true behind the scenes, that's what they presented to the public. And so you could be like, oh, I'm a fan of Lynn Wood, and I'm also a fan of General Flynn. And like that's, there's no tension, right? You don't have to choose sides. And I think, you know, now it's their fight, everyone's fighting, they're so upset with each other, but people are still like, I mean, most like normal people are not going to be like, oh, these two want to fight, I have to pick a side. So, you know, I think it's a little easier, whereas like when it comes to like fascism, I mean, you start to get into this like strange, like, you know, there's like the American Populist Union that broke off from like Nick Fuentes and his Groypers, and you know, that kind of fractured, like who is like cool with who and who talks to who. And so that gets a little bit more difficult. And there's also like within fascism, you've got like now because of Joe Kent, it's, you know, inclusive populism, but it's like that like brand of like Populism Inc. where it's like Bannon and, you know, it's like corporate. I mean, like Nick Fuentes is always saying like Bannon is basically a Marxist because he just cares about class over, you know, race. And so like to a person who's not a white nationalist or a fascist, like hearing Bannon is a Marxist is, you know, absurd. It doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, their community is so, so fractured, and they really have a harder time like coming together, I feel like, than QAnon people. And maybe some of that too is just that QAnon people are so obsessed with like whatever, like conspiracy or whatever's like put in front of their faces, that to ask that they also follow the interpersonal drama of these influencers it's just asking too much. Like, there's only so many hours in the day. And so it's like, do you want to find the pedophiles, or do you want to, like, you know, sit and ponder how you feel about, you know, General Flynn versus Lynn Wood? So yeah, I mean, I think that on a smaller level, the same stuff happens. Like, when Nick Fuentes goes somewhere, it's like a big deal. You know, when Big Alaska walks in a room, it's a big deal. So when John Doyle walks into a bar, it's people lose their shit. But you have to already be within that community. And there's also, like, you know, like, we're not, those names I just named, like, those aren't people who are going to be interviewed on CNN. But, you know, Flynn and Powell and Wood, these are people that, like, an average human in America might know about. So yeah, I think it just, they just have a smaller pool of people that they can, like, get celebrity from. And then on top of that, they have a lot of infighting within them. So I think if more people were willing to be open and white nationalists and open fascists, we might see that celebrity status more similar to QAnon, if that makes sense.
No, it really does. Like, it makes a lot of sense. And then I think, like, the big question in my mind is, like, how much of this space is, like, defined by grifting? Like, I know it sounds kind of goofy, but, like, I think of, like, he's not a general anymore, I guess, Michael Flynn's arc. He goes from, you know, being really accomplished in the military, head of the DIA, and, you know, kind of aimless for a while with no discernible income. But, like, I just really, like, I'm curious, like, how much of this space that you saw, that you interacted with, is defined by grift, by, like, you know, making money, you know, it's, you know, thousands of dollars to come to hear somebody speak, et cetera, et cetera. And then how much of it was a true believer? And I don't really have a good definition for a true believer, so I'll kind of let you define it for us. But like, how much, what is that tension? How much of it was grift? How much of it was true believers? What is the interaction between the two, I guess?
I think it's a lot of both. So, you know, like, Flynn is, like, famously a grifter. And I mean, that's part of what him and Lynn Wood were fighting about, because Lynn Wood doesn't take a speaking fee, but Lynn Wood is also rich. And, you know, Michael Flynn is a bunch of debt. but, you know, Flynn was taking, you know, an obscene amount of money for speaking fees, you know, based on, like, the rumor mill. And, you know, like, Brad Barton, like, I, even once my cover was blown, I attended, he started to try to push his followers into this MLM. It's like, I did the onboarding, you know, I started the onboarding process with a fake identity with them, because I wanted to see what he was, you know, pushing his followers to. And, like, it's obviously a grip. I mean, but there's definitely people, like, I think Mike Lindell's all in. I think he's a real believer. you know, and I think too, people get really focused on this grift aspect, and they're like, oh, like, so-and-so is in it just for the grab. And I think that's true sometimes, but at the end of the day, if you divide people up in any group, you know, I voted for and campaigned for Bernie Sanders. If you put, you know, 500 Bernie Sanders fans in a room, or, like, I love to go hiking. If you put 500 people who love to go hiking in a room, some of them are going to be grifters, right? Some of them are going to be assholes. Some of them are going to be gullible idiots. Like, that's just people, right? There's nothing, like, there's no, like, test against these things to come in. So I don't even necessarily know that, like, this community has, like, a grifter problem any more than any other community would have a grifter problem. But, you know, I think that it does bring most of these people together, even the grifters. And I personally know some of these grifters who are not names that you would know, but who are vendors at all of these things. They're making money. They're making an amazing living. They're cleaning up. But they are, you know, they donate a shit ton of money to Donald Trump. They're true believers. They really believe the election was stolen. These are people who have no reason to lie to me. So, you know, I think it's a little bit of just kind of everything across the board. The fascists, you know, like, I went to the Roger Stone thing. I flew out of Tampa for it. It was $125. It was open bar for like 3 hours. Like, that's not a bad deal, right? I mean, yeah, the whole time Roger Stone is like begging us to give him more money. But at the end of the day, the ticket itself, you got to hang out with Roger Stone, you know, in this really tiny space. There were other people there that, you know, also suck. But if you're into that kind of thing, you might be super thrilled to be there. You know, like APU, I think my ticket for that was like $20. So yeah, like those, the younger fascists, like part of what they make fun of is like the grifting aspect of the other stuff. You know, take out like Q and just put in MAGA, you know, I paid, I think, $500 to see Matt Gaetz give a speech at Trump's Doral. It ended up, every outlet was there, like CNN was there, like MSNBC was there, like local outlets. I mean, there were literally like 30 cameramen filming the speech that I paid $500 for. They had it in an area where you could see like everything from the balcony. So you didn't even have to pay. You could have just stood on the balcony. And as soon as Gaetz was done giving the speech, like 8 minutes, he like left, you know, and it was a $500, like, of course, it's like a huge grift. And that's like Women for America First. So like, she's a grifter. I mean, there's like people within the community, people are like, that person is a grifter. Like, everybody knows Women for America First is, you know, a grifting, you know, con artist thing. QAnon John, people suggested, but you know, I don't know. I didn't go to his second event, so it's like hard for me to say. So I think a lot of the organizers themselves are like grifters. And then I think, you know, a lot of people like use the platform to grift. But I also think that if you had like a left-leaning movement that brought out this same level of emotion in people, you would have also a bunch of grifters within it. So yeah, but I mean, definitely with the younger fascists, like they are like populist. And so their events are like $20, $125, you know, or free. So those are much more accessible than some of the QAnon things.
This is going to sound like a silly question, but I've just been kind of really curious about this. What's the swag like? Like, is there like Q t-shirts? Is there like pro-fash t-shirts, I guess? Because like when I go to conferences for my work, like there's just like grab bags of like t-shirts, challenge coins, pens, everything's branded. Woohoo! And I'm just kind of curious. I know this is kind of a jokey question, but like, you know, when you go to these places, what's the swag like? Are you like at your home or apartment? You just have like a bag full of like Q branded like challenge coins and pens? Like, can you describe that for us?
Yeah, so the QAnon events, if you buy the VIP ticket, you get a swag bag. So I've got like a poster of Donald Trump hugging a flag. I've got this like Where We Go One, We Go All mug. I've got, you know, those like the rubber bracelets that like say stuff on them. I've got a whole bunch like Digital Soldier, like Trump 45. Like, I've got a whole bunch of those. One of my VIP swag bags had Patrick Byrne's book, Big Lie, or whatever his stupid book is called. It's terrible. It's just like he just like printed out a bunch of news articles and like hyperlinks and put it in the book, but like it's a book, so you can't like click on the links because it's a book. Yeah, I have like all kinds of like weird stuff. The best thing I got, so I did tell like my Patreon subscribers, and like you reminded me, I like have to go back and like message everybody and get them to give me their addresses, that like, because I couldn't post a lot of stuff when I was on the cover, I was like, no, I'll send, you know, at random, I'll send this stuff out. But something I'm not sending out is I got a retracto, the alpaca from Project Veritas. I also got COVID, so I joke he's like my pox blanket, and I hope that joke does not get me canceled, but I will not give him away. That retracto, the alpaca, he's mine forever. And you can buy one yourself at the Project Veritas store for $50. It's just like a little stuffed animal. Like, it's like the size of my hand. It's not even big. But he was my favorite thing I got.
That's pretty funny. Like, it just, that was part of like so curious about that. Like, do they just give you bags and stuff? And so we've discussed kind of these two threads, the QAnon and the FASH thread. So I was wondering, as you kind of moved up into like CPAC and sort of more official conservative movement events, what was that like? Did you kind of see the QAnon and the FASH threads kind of combine at these conservative, like mainstream? Like, I'm kind of leery to use the word mainstream because I don't, it's so in flux that you don't know where the mainstream is. But like when you went to, like, you know, I shouldn't say when you went to, but when you interacted with kind of people who identify as Republican or as conservative, like, how did they kind of process QAnon and the FASH? Like, was there a processing? Was there a reconciliation? Or, you know, was it more subtle and you kind of had to poke and prod until you got some stuff out?
So at CPAC, I only went to CPAC in February. So there's for the first time ever, there were two CPACs. There's always one in February. It's usually in the DC area. And then last year, and then this year, it was in Orlando, Florida. And then for the first time ever, there was like a mid-year CPAC in Texas in July. And I was going to go and I didn't. And I kind of regret not going, but it is what it is. So this was February, you know, it was a little early on, you know, people kind of would bring up QAnon stuff and like talk around it, or they would say QAnon stuff without like realizing, or maybe not acknowledging that they were discussing, you know, QAnon ideals. When I was at Women for America First, the Trump to rally in April, Landon and Robbie Starbuck were there, and this event was like very QAnon heavy. So, you know, Robbie Starbuck is running for Congress in Tennessee, and his wife, you know, gives this speech about how, like, you know, the Democrats want, you know, critical race theory taught in schools because CRT makes kids more susceptible to be child sex trafficked, and that Democrats love child sex trafficking, and, you know, stuff like that. People just kind of like roll with it. People would talk, you know, someone talking about like Monsters, Inc. So you would see it, and like people don't say QAnon, they just say all the other stuff, right? So it's just like, it's kind of how like when you're like, oh, that person can't be a racist, like he's never said the N-word in front of me, but it's like, okay, but he says like a bunch of racist stuff. You know, do you need it spelled, like, do you have to have it spelled out that way? And so that's how they handled it. And then as far as like regular Republicans, like fascists, you know, at CPAC, I went to like a Laura Loomer thing, and it just was, you know, there was no like discussion of it. But the group that I was hanging out with, they, you know, recruit normie GOP people to come to their stuff, and they are, you know, they're a bunch of white nationalists. They're a bunch of members of hate groups, or former members of hate groups, or, you know, very closely connected to people who are members or former members of hate groups, and only former members largely because these groups closed down, right? So, you know, they set up, they do things at TPUSA, they do things at CPAC, and they want to bring over those normie people. And I mean, you know, it's like you're saying, like, you know, people being weird is like, that's like fine. But, you know, young fascists are very concerned about optics. Like, that's been a thing for like a long time. You know, that was a thing, like Charlottesville, that was a thing. I mean, Nick Fuentes has always talked about optics. And one of the organizations that exists now, APU, like, they exist, you know, pretty much directly to combat the bad optics of Nick Fuentes. You know, they're Groypers, and they're, you know, some of them are fans of his, but they just have kind of created their own spinoff group because he's too toxic. And so, you know, for Nick Fuentes to host an event, it's going to be a little bit more difficult, like AFPAC or something that's going to draw more media attention. But there's other groups that have the exact same, you know, like mindset on everything. And they kind of like fly under the radar, and because the media doesn't bring them up, like, you know, random people don't know, so then they go, and then maybe they hear something that they like, and they kind of like get pulled in that way. So yeah, it's, I think, you know, nobody really talks about it at TPUSA or CPAC, or, you know, and if they do, you know, because every year Rapers always go into TPUSA and during Q&A try to like ask questions that will upset speakers. And, you know, that might be like the one time where something comes up or whatever. But yeah, in general, it's kind of just don't bring it up. Just keep on among the population of people, like the general attendees. You don't really hear anybody talk about it, or I didn't.
That's interesting. Like they're, please correct me if I'm wrong, they're let into the conference. They have a table at the conference, but nobody talks about it. Because I'm trying to pair.
No. Oh. Well, sorry, Rob, but let me clarify.
Okay.
So the group I was hanging out with, yes, they are a sponsor. They're an exhibitor at CPAC and Training Point USA. But the group that like is younger and is like a direct response to the backlash against Nick Fuentes, they are not allowed into the TPUSA, but they do hold satellite events directly across the street. So like people can just go. And I mean, I went and it was packed. Every seat was taken. It was standing. People were standing. I had a VIP ticket, so I had a seat, but like otherwise you had to stand. There were so many people. So it just depends. I mean, I think that like also like the group that I was hanging out with, Public International Renewal, like these guys are not, you know, like nobody's associating them with, you know, white nationalism, even, and I don't know why, like I can't answer why, even though, you know, like one of the guys, it's like their grassroots director used to run a podcast called, you know, Blood, Soil, Liberty, which really is, you know, obviously a callback to Nazi Germany. It's like half and half, but I don't know why people don't realize it. But yeah, sorry if that clarifies it a little bit for you.
No, it does. And I'm trying to just, I think this part of the conversation, what I really have a hard time kind of thinking about is the goofballs. So Boebert, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Paul Gosar, but they also, I characterize them as goofballs because they're, I don't know what else to call them. But they also seem to be the ones who are, mainstreaming is the right word. Like I know Boebert, when she ran for CO3, her seat, she was a QAnon person, or she at least paid lip service to QAnon's ideology. And I think the imagery for Marjorie Taylor Greene is, I think it was last week when she showed up, I think with Nick Fuentes. I'm not sure. I need to go back and check, but like, how do we think about like the relationship of CPAC and elected officials? Like, are elected officials kind of, you know, sending their staffers to these, you know, to talk to these white nationalists and Q people? Are they being like kind of, you know, brought into the constituency fold? Like, did you ever see that mechanism playing out? Did you ever see that sort of, you know, explicit courting of the QAnon and the FASH as a constituent? Or is it just kind of like what you've kind of already said, like they're just being ignored and kind of, you know, kind of shrugging their shoulders at them?
So last year at CPAC 2021, Nick Fuentes had AFPAC, and it was Friday night. And Friday night, Gosar was a speaker. The next night, the group that I ended up befriending some of the guys in, Republicans for National Renewal, had another event where Gosar was a speaker with Laura Loomer and Marjorie Taylor Greene. And at the end of the event, the guys running Republicans for National Renewal thank them for being there and thank their staffers for their help with a caucus that they were all working on together. So, I mean, yeah, they're like all working together. And then yes, last week at FPAC, Marjorie Taylor Greene was a speaker and she wasn't announced until the event had started. But considering the year before, she had, you know, talked with a speaker and Laura Loomer, who was also a speaker at AFPAC, you know, 24 hours after AFPAC ended. Like, it's not, you know, it's like shocking, but not surprising. So yeah, like that's a pretty like direct. QAnon is more, I think, a little more cautious with QAnon, to be honest, than they are with white nationalism, just because white nationalism and like mainstream Republican ideals, I mean, stuff that like Christopher Cantwell was saying, you know, years ago, is now stuff that like mainstream Republicans say. So I think it's a little bit more acceptable than like there's kids under the Getty or whatever QAnon, you know, conspiracy. So that I think is a little bit more like tread lightly, and people, I mean, Anthony Sabatini will no longer say if he, you know, believes in QAnon, but he's still hanging out with Republicans International Renewal, a group of fascists and white nationalists, without any problem. So I think it just, you know, I think fascism is more acceptable than QAnon is a direct acceptance. And you know, like when Marjorie Taylor Greene got called out for being at AFPAC, and she was like, oh, I didn't even know Nick Fuentes was, you know, in like the chats and like the Fuentes chats, some people would like get upset and everybody else would be like, you're an idiot. You don't understand how the game is played, because there's like a low key denouncing of Nick Fuentes. And then there's like, you know, like I denounce Nick Fuentes, you know, kind of thing. So she didn't lose, you know, any like goodwill. Yeah, I mean, everybody is still very happy with her. On that end. So she's definitely playing the game and knows what to say and how to handle things.
This might be beyond the scope of the conversation, but it's like, it almost seems like they're using CPAC as a way to lobby. No, that can't be. I guess that's the only verb that comes to my mind. Like it's to lobby, to suggest legislation, to even write legislation, because like if you're forming a caucus, if you're influencing staffers with intention of influencing the principal, it's like that's really well put together. I keep having this, probably need to change it, but I keep having this like image of these, of the fash being like goofballs. They're kind of losers, but now the way that you've described it, it's like kind of scary. Like they have a very kind of plan or a direction or a focus, I guess. I don't know how to describe it, but it's I'm kind of scared. I don't know why I'm laughing, but
yeah, I mean it's a explicit like direct like plan thing is, you know, to recruit people from these events for sure for the fascists. So let me think, like I kind of get hazy, like, because behind the scenes is definitely something people talk about, but I don't know how much it's, like, talked about, like, you know, super publicly, but it's definitely, you know, that is what people want to do. But I also, like, want to be clear, like, when I talk about these people, and some of the stories that I share and the text messages that I've shared, you know, I've been told, like, oh, like, you're making them sound like caricatures of people, but it's, like, no, this is who they are. I mean, some of it is, like, this person is an idiot, you know, and they're saying and doing stupid things, and they're, like, failing to come to certain realizations about how, like, humans function, but they're also, you know, trying to, like, plan out and kind of successfully planning out, you know, some of this stuff, so it's both. It's both, you know, they're like kind of buffoons. You know, I had someone tell me like that the Proud Boys Antifa riot in Portland was going to be, you know, the most culture that Portland had had. He said it's going to be, he's like, since COVID, you know, there's nothing going on. He said it'll be more culture than you would see at a slam poetry event or a farmer's market, which is like, why are those the two things? You know what I mean? Like, why are those your two suggestions of events that people go to? Slam poetry events and farmer's markets? Like, what? But, you know, he's like, oh, you know, we have to go. He's like, we can like have like dinner and like watch, you know, from a bridge as they, you know, like fight each other. And like, it sounds like a cartoon character. It's like, there's no way somebody would really say some of this dumb shit, but they say it, and he really doesn't see how what he said to me is weird. You know what I mean? But it's just like a fundamental misunderstanding of how other people like function. Cause I would never tell my friends, we have to go to this. It's going to be more culture than a farmer's market. Like, no one talks like that, but in his mind, that's how people like talk. If that makes sense.
No, it does. It does. So I kind of want to, my second to last question kind of circles back to you. And in this last year of going through all these spaces, you know, going to QAnon events, FASH events, political events, how did that change you? Like, did it make you more extreme? Did it make you more likely to just openly, you know, reject these values? Like, what, you know, a year is a long time in kind of, you know, relative terms. And I guess, like, did you feel like you grew during this time? Did you feel like you've lost something? What was that internal change? Like, you know, however you're comfortable with tackling the question.
I mean, I'm not super sure that, like, I'm a different person than I was a year and a half ago, which is, I think, kind of a disappointing answer. You know, I see a lot of value in what I did. In a lot of ways, like, my life is forever changed. But that's not, you know, if you're asking about, like, my internal, like, value set, like, no, I fucking hate these people. I hated them a year ago. I hated them 2 years ago. And I am today, right? Like, it's not... You know, if I was going to be tempted by white nationalism or fascism, like, that ship would have sailed by now, you know, or even like Trumpism, right? Like, you know, my family, a lot of Trump voters in my family, a lot of people I do the Libertarian Party, you know, have moved on to become Proud Boys or whatever. I would have already done it. And this is like why I tell people don't do what I did, because I think it would be tempting for a lot of people. And I never would want someone to get hurt or like become a fascist because I said, you know, going undercover was great and everybody should do it. I don't know. I mean, like, my actual day-to-day life is now, well, for the rest of my life, be very different. But, you know, the core of who I am is still the same.
That's awesome. For our last question, we always throw it to you, the guest, which is leave us, me as the interviewer, the audience, whomever, something to think about, something to chew on, something to mull over, something to kind of remember and to think about. Go.
Oh, jeez. Oh, that's okay. It's so broad. I would say what I took away the most from what I did and what I would hope other people do as well, is that in the near future, I think there will be a push on both sides. And I mean, there already has been. Look at the, you know, the Medicare for All like rallies for people on the left to have an alliance with some of these right-wing extremists. And it's going to be because, you know, a lot of these fascists are populist and a lot of ideas that they have sound great for everybody, but their ideas aren't meant for everybody. And so just, you know, always remember when a white nationalist fascist says a populist statement, at the end of that sentence, they mean for us. They don't mean for everyone. I want everyone to be wary of that as we move forward into midterms and the presidential election, because some of the stuff they have to say sounds really good, but they don't mean it on a large scale.
Powerful words. So with that was our guest, Amanda Moore. Please make sure to just go follow her on Twitter, you know, like, she does great coverage on her through her account. Really great work. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Of course.